one of the epigraphs to my book, Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, is from Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys. Biafra advises, don't just whine about the media, do something about it, become the media. And more young activists like the people at Radio Free Santa Cruz, the people that are putting out Green Pages, a very impressive piece of journalism that appears every 2 weeks. This is very heartening. And all over the country, you see more and more young people becoming engaged with the media, creating their own media, because we have a very serious public health problem in this country. Perhaps the Surgeon General should start labeling various corporate media outlets with dangerous to your health. What has evolved, particularly in the corporate-controlled media, over the last several decades, has just been an enormous concentration of power through a series of mergers and takeovers that has been enabled by both the political parties, which are so closely entrenched with corporate media power. And you have to locate the corporate media within larger media organizations. So CBS is part of Viacom, a huge multinational conglomerate that owns Simon & Schuster, one of the largest book publishers. It owns Blockbuster Video. It has numerous holdings. And that is true of all of the six major media monopolies. Now, when Ben Bagdikian wrote the first edition of Media Monopoly, a classic book, it came out in 1983, and he identified 50 corporations as controlling most of the media in the United States. And if you go back and look at the reviews of his book, he was largely dismissed. He was described as someone who was hyperbolic, exaggerating the situation, someone who didn't have faith in the free market's ability to constantly produce more and more and diverse media outlets. Well, Bagdikian has a very interesting track record. He's published 5 editions of The Media Monopoly since then. Incidentally, the book is published by Beacon Press, one of the handful of independent presses left in the United States. In the second edition of Media Monopoly, 50 became 28. Third edition, 23, then 14, then 10. In the last edition that came out in 2000, the number is down to 6. 3 of them, incidentally, are not even US-based. Vivendi is a French conglomerate, Bertelsmann is German, and News Corporation is, well, you can more or less call it Australian-American, owned by Rupert Murdoch. So we have a very serious problem for democracy here in the United States that is intimately connected with corporate control of media. And this is something that the so-called founding fathers, in a very odd way, had some premonition of. Much of Jefferson and Madison's writings about the need for a citizenry to be well-informed and connecting that with a thriving and, if you will, robust democracy. I hate to use such a term like robust because in the corporate propaganda today, it's almost entirely linked to military action. So you hear these two buzzwords now, robust and muscular. But be that as it may, there is a direct connection between the information needs, the communication needs of a citizenry and what the corporations are providing. And there's a huge gap there. We have, as I describe in the book, a range of opinion that is, instead of A to Z, is more like A to B, and is more like GE to GM. There isn't that pluralism that people need, that the citizenry need, in order to become informed, in order to really realize the essence of democracy, so that the demos, the people rule and not the corporations. So media is central to this. Bagdikian understood this very well when he called these media conglomerates a private ministry of information. And then he added that there is no single force more powerful than the media in the shaping of public opinion. So that briefly kind of describes the situation now we have in the commercial media. In the United States. It's a very serious situation, a situation that has been made even worse yesterday by a court ruling which was covered in about 70 seconds this morning on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. If you had just turned your head or flipped your omelet, you would have missed it. But this has enormous implications for the communication needs of a democratic society. The court ruling was that the media monopolies were now able to have even more ownership and cross-ownership. In other words, you can own newspapers and magazines as well as televisions and radio stations in the same market. So this will enable even more concentration and even more monopoly control of information. So in a way, the corporations do pose a serious, corporate control of media does pose a serious public health problem. It's like they have their grip around our windpipe, and we are gasping as citizens for breath, for air, for information. We have this enormous incapacity because we do not have enough sources, we do not have enough nodes, we don't have enough information coming in order to replenish our own blood cells, and we are reduced to a kind of torpor, which is exactly their view of us, their being the corporate state elite. They want to see us as passive spectators, shop till we drop. We are the bewildered herd, as Walter Lippmann, one of the major theorists of liberal democratic theory, said. And the thinking has to be done, decision-making has to be done by a specialized class. This is Harold Laswell, again, one of the major proponents of so-called liberal democratic thinking in the earlier part of the 20th century. In this backdrop, where does public radio and public TV come in? It plays a very crucial and central role. And the founding document for public broadcasting, I urge you to look at it. I discuss it in my book. It's called the Carnegie Commission Report. It was written not by radicals, not by left liberals or some Marxist fringe group, but by the very top echelon elite of American corporate power, people like an academic power, the head of MIT, the head of Harvard, James Conant, the head of Eastman Kodak, and other major corporations. In that document, they said the United States, I want to emphasize all of these terms and their direct quotes, should have a non-commercial, it's very unambiguous, doesn't say underwriting, doesn't say somewhat commercial, doesn't say partly commercial, says a non-commercial public radio and TV broadcasting system. This was later codified that same year in legislation that Lyndon Johnson signed. In no ambiguous terms, the United States was supposed to have a non-commercial broadcast system. The other things in the Carnegie Commission report, which were largely reflected in the congressional legislation, which passed in the record time from the issuance of the report, within a few months, it was passed and signed by LBJ. It was the last piece of Great Society legislation that Johnson was able to get through Congress. It said very clearly that public broadcasting in the United States should provide a voice for those who are otherwise unheard in the community. That's a direct quote. It should be a forum for controversy and debate, and it should be diverse. All of these things were part of the founding document of public broadcasting. Now, as many of you have probably experienced firsthand, you know when you turn on PBS, sometimes mockingly called Petroleum Broadcasting Service, because of the plethora of ads, I'm not going to use that undignified Orwellian term of underwriting, because it's not. It's an ad. It's a straight-out advertisement. And if you listen to KQED, as I did this morning, here and there, in between news reports brought to you by Walnut Creek Ford, and here's their 800 number, and visit their website. AT&T, who's providing this cell phone for you, here's their 800 number. Straight-out commercialization, not very different from what's going on in the rest of the media. Public broadcasting started very quickly taking pressure from the political right. Nixon vetoed one of its first appropriations, and that sent a message that we are going to watch you very closely, so you better watch what you put on the air. PBS has always been a focus of the right wing, and one of the drumbeats of propaganda that is incessantly being echoed over and over again in the corporate media is that public radio and public TV is somehow liberal left in their content. Well, again, it's not rocket science. You can do the investigation yourself. You are consumers. Just turn on the TV. What do you see? The EastEnders. What do you see? The Exxon Mobil Masterpiece Theater. What do you see? Wall Street Week in Review with street with a dollar sign. What do you see? You see Washington Week in Review, Ben Wattenberg's think tank, Tony Brown's journal, African Animals Without Africans. That's very crucial. All the nature shows on PBS somehow are in, these animals have dropped from outer space into these countries. And there are no Africans. There's no context. There's no people around them. Antiques Roadshow, which is now being duplicated. There's an Antiques Roadshow UK that has just been introduced. They can't get enough of it. Every single one of the PBS programs really does have a bias. I mean, if you come to the evidence without prejudice and just examine who are the voices that get on these programs, it's something you can do yourself. What institutions they represent, and what they say, you can come to some very, I think, interesting conclusions that will throw that lie that NPR and PBS, are somehow left liberal right out the window. Because any examination will show that over and over again, the golden Rolodex of pundits that are called upon on these programs represent institutions of power that are significantly to the right, like the American Enterprise Institute, like the Brookings Institution, like the Heritage Foundation, like the Manhattan Institute, like the Hudson Institute, the Cato Institute, and on and on. All of these pundits are recycled in all of these programs, and they move effortlessly from PBS and NPR to the commercial media. So you have Cokie Roberts, without meeting a beat, pundifying with Bob Edwards on Morning Edition one day and then appearing on ABC News that very evening. You have the insufferable Mark Shields, who represents the left on the Snooze Hour with Jim Lehrer. He's there representing obviously some Trotskyite radical left faction. He's there one night on the News Hour, and the next night you see him on CNN's firing line, holding down that particular fort. So there's, as government officials move back and forth between the private sector and so-called public service, we also see that same kind of movement from people in public radio and TV going into the commercial end of it as well. Let me give you some examples, because I think that makes the case more than rhetoric and just talking about things, because it's the proof is in the pudding, and the proof is in the content of the programming. I was listening. I was driving to Denver. I'll give you just a couple of examples from National Public Radio, and I was going back and forth between Colorado Public Radio, which is like KQED, let's say, mainstream, NPR, wall-to-wall, hours and hours of Morning Edition, hours and hours of Terry Gross, Prairie Home Companion, Car Talk, hours and hours of All Things Considered. And I was also listening to KGNU, a remarkable community radio station. So here was a perfect case study of what vibrant, engaged community radio sounds like and what corporatized NPR radio sounds like. And I'm going back and forth as I'm driving. On KGNU, the community radio station where I have my radio roots, I'm proud to say, there's Arundhati Roy of India, a brilliant writer, thinker, an incredibly articulate woman, talking about the impact of globalization on India, and also talking about the incredibly negative effect that a Houston-based energy company was having on the Indian people. A Houston-based energy company known as Enron. And it was a fascinating discussion how Enron swooped down on India and literally hijacked the energy sector of India's most populous state, Maharashtra. It was going back and forth, and then going over to Colorado Public Radio, and then they said, we're going to have a feature now coming up on the economic crisis in Argentina. Well, since I was very familiar with the Arundhati Roy program, and I happened to have produced it and recorded it, I felt I could spare some ego massaging and move over and listen to this report, because I wanted to hear about the economic crisis in Argentina. And this was NPR in its essence. A brilliant, and I'm going to use some radio jargon here, a brilliant radio piece layered and textured with audio sound, with all kinds of very high production values, you know, excellent writing, cutaways, fades, all the things that, you know, make, you know, radio producers just tingle, and the kind of stuff that wins awards at these radio events. And you hear the stories from Buenos Aires of people who were in great economic deprivation. There was an interview with a tango singer who was on a railway station platform now singing for his sustenance, essentially. Some months before, he had been in the ritziest clubs of Buenos Aires singing, but now he was reduced to singing on a platform and earning a few devalued pesos. And there were interviews with women, with children trying to make ends meet, working several jobs. Very interesting, high-powered, moving radio. It also had great pacing. You know, they didn't focus a lot. It kept moving. There was, again, a lot of this, a lot of intersection of voices and sounds. There was one thing missing. There was not a single mention of the word neoliberalism. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization. So if you were your average Martian on a visit to Earth, you know, I just landed in Area 52 and were driving around and hearing this program, you would think, well, it's the luck of the draw, you know, those poor Argentinians, you know, things happen, you know, it's tough luck. You know, I guess looking at the map, they're there at the bottom of the world and, you know, probably problems just fall on them. And that's it. And that's why I say this was a quintessential NPR report reportage. No history, no context, no background. Things just happen. Hey, it's tough. And then going back to KGNU, the community radio station, you hear, you know, Arundhati Roy, incidentally uninterrupted. All of these things, before and after the piece on NPR, there were announcements for various corporate underwriters, Archer Daniels Midland, AT&T, I mean, you name them. They're just now just dropped in as kind of, you know, part of the backdrop of the reporting. Directly, incidentally, in contravention to the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. Which said specifically that there were to be no commercials. But the FCC, working with the two parties, or the one party, or whatever you want to call it, they found this loophole and were able to use the euphemism underwriting, you know, which is pure Orwell, of course. Well, that was January 23rd. This morning, you know, a glutton for punishment, I turn on KQED, listening to Morning Edition. Again, the same kind of phenomenon occurs. A very well-produced piece on the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City with Howard Berkus, lots of audio texture, and, you know, fine, okay, it was about an African-American woman, the first African-American woman who wins the bobsledding. Okay, you know, sports are cool, I'm not totally against it. And then there was a commentary from Frank Dufort about the perils of refereeing and, you know, they don't always get it right. You know, as the Oakland Raiders found out, and as, you know, that whole controversy around the Canadian and Russian ice skating competition, you know, who really won. And there was a discussion about that. That immediately went into, I almost missed it because I did turn away for a second, I think I was shaving, and there was this very quick report about the court decision yesterday, which is going to enable more corporate concentration of media, a very significant event, and you know, goes right to the heart of the communication needs and the crisis we have in the media in this country. And you barely heard it. It was about 70 seconds. That was followed by a commercial from the 21st Century Insurance Company. And then they went into a whole other range of local commercials, including, as I said, Walnut Creek Ford. I'm still listening. And then the next featured program after the news headlines is about faulty intelligence leading to civilian deaths in Afghanistan. And this was hosted, of course, by the inimitable Bob Edwards. So here was a report because it had become front page news on the New York in the New York Times about 10 days ago, that a lot of these so-called US smart bombs have not been very smart at all. They've been acting very unsmartly and falling on Afghan civilians and in some case actual allies of US forces. This was a story that has been circulating in the alternative independent media when the first smart bomb started dropping in October. But it took the corporate-controlled media almost until, well, the middle of February. February 10th is when the Times reported on it for the first time, and then NPR picked up on it today. I have to tell you a little anecdote. Once I snuck into an NPR editorial meeting. It's quite a coup, actually. I pretended I was one of them, one of their, like, you know, I'm NPR Colorado, and, you know, I want to see how you do things. And it was very instructive to see how they were deciding on what would be the evening news that you would hear on All Things Considered. It was literally taking the front page of the New York Times and then assigning people. Okay, you cover that. Taking the Wall Street Journal and one or two other, and the Washington Post, and saying, okay, you do this, you do that, we'll do this, we'll do that. I mean, there was no originality. There was very little creativity going on there as well. They were essentially relying on the print media to set the agenda for them. And we have the usual golden Rolodex of experts. All guys, you'll be happy to hear. All white guys, you'll be even happier to hear. Milt Bearden, ex-CIA guy, he was talking about, well, you know, it's Afghanistan is it's a rough terrain for our military to operate in. You know, in one valley you got Aminullah Khan, and another valley you got Vali Khan, and you can get these Khans mixed up, and you know, it's easy to get confused, and one Khan is saying a bad word about another one, and there are these vendettas, and you know, we're relying on this information, and you know, we don't have enough ground intelligence to know what's really going on, and you know, occasionally mistakes happen. Interesting, another classic Orwellism, which you'll have to always be on your tiptoes to catch. Mistakes were made. Civilians were killed. Rumsfeld said this in the same broadcast. So there's no agency there. You know, it just happened. Civilians were killed. Mistakes were made. I didn't make a mistake. Edwards doesn't have a clue. I mean, he really is monumentally uninformed. He never asks any questions. He never challenges any of these pundits, unlike if he ever had someone who was challenging conventional wisdoms. Then he's there with, what about the critics who say this? What about, you can't finish a sentence. But that doesn't happen very often on Morning Edition. You're well protected because Edwards is there, you know, really looking out for your interests. And your interests are the national interests. The national interest of the state and the corporate nexus that essentially is dominating the state. The next guest was Anthony Cordesman of the Georgetown Center on Strategic Studies, a well-known hawk. He was followed. Did I misspeak? No one lies. I never lie. I misspeak, or something was misspoken. But again, there's no agency. Cordesman is on. He's followed by another CIA agent, ex-Special Forces guy, Michael Vickers. He's then followed by yet another CIA agent who has a new book. I'm not making this up. You can get the transcript. Robert Baer. And he's finally followed by a consultant from a I didn't quite get his affiliation. I'm going to get the actual transcript of this so that I can, you know, make these citations. His name was George Friedman. So there was no countervailing force. There was no counterpoint in the piece at all. Oh, then they had a sound clip from Rumsfeld, where he said civilians, you know, were killed, mistakes were made, and then another sound clip from another State War Department FLAC, Victoria Clark, who said basically the same thing. And then that, you know, the piece closed, you know, it came to some kind of closure. That's very typical of the kind of reporting that you get in the corporate media, but we expect more from National Public Radio. We expect more, and we should hold their feet to the fire. We want journalists to do their jobs as journalists and not to genuflect and be in awe and act in some kind of, have some reverence for the people that they're interviewing, but to ask cutting-edge questions, to ask the challenging questions, to ask the questions that may occur to you as citizens that need to be asked. So there's a classic adage in journalism, you know, to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Most of these journalists today, they've turned that upside down. They comfort the comfortable and afflict the afflicted. Instead of holding people with power, holding their feet to the fire, they're throwing flowers at them. They have chronic journalistic diseases such as wee-wee-itis, a fatal disease. For example, Margaret Warner, who is one of the most acute practitioners of this terminal disease, frequently talks about what are we going to do about Saddam Hussein? When should we attack Iraq? Here's a transcript when she was interviewing Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, a frequent guest. She's talking here, this is Warner, about our war on terror. Our war on terror. We're in this together. And then she's talking about, I'm quoting here, there's a real problem with the leaders in the Arab Muslim world in not responding to terrorism, and how do we get them to do that? Here's Jim Lehrer from the 17th of January interviewing Bülent Ecevit, the Prime Minister of Turkey. Now, a report had just been issued by Human Rights Watch calling the situation of human rights inside of Turkey extremely serious. They used the word rampant, rampant use of torture, and an enormous amount of persecution of the ethnic Kurdish minority, who Ecevit, throughout this interview, referred to as either terrorists or ethnic Turks. See, in Turkey, not only is the language of the Kurdish people forbidden, there are 12 to 15 million Turkish citizens of Kurdish descent. They mostly live in eastern Turkey, where my family's from, Anatolia. Their main city is Diyarbakir. The Kurdish language is forbidden, and 3,500 Kurdish villages have been obliterated. 2 million Kurds have been created as internal refugees, and tens of thousands of Kurds have been killed. And right now, there's hunger fasts in Turkish prisons that are being conducted by leftists, and more than a score of these prisoners have died because of their protest against the inhuman conditions that they're being held under in Turkish jails. And so Lehrer is asking, well, what do you say to critics who suggest, you know, that there may be a human rights problem inside of Turkey? And Ecevit, of course, being a U.S. ally, much like Israel, has a permanent get-out-of-jail pass. He can say virtually anything on the U.S. media, including public media like PBS. He said that these are all terrorists, we have a terrorist situation, and we have it under control. You, American citizens, now are experiencing firsthand the kind of terrorism that Turkey has been experiencing for the last 20 years, and he called the PKK a terrorist organization. And one of the deadly things that you find on the snooze hour is that they open the show invariably with a clip from a government FLAC, what the government is saying about a particular issue, and then the discussion that follows is framed around that. Well, you just heard Donald Rumsfeld say that Iraq is a serious threat to peace in the Middle East. You know, what should we do about Iraq? Again, using the royal we. So almost every night you have, I'm not making this man's name up, Rear Admiral Stufflebeam. I'm not making his name up. That's his name. You know, with his fruit salad of medals and his pointer, you know, saying, talking about the smart bombs hitting the, you know, the hard targets, and we're routing out the Taliban. No, we don't know where Osama bin Laden is, but, you know, we hope to track him down. Whatever happened to Osama bin Laden? He's become the real mystery man. And then, you know, Rumsfeld is on with his latest pronouncements, and Victoria Clark, also who is a War Department spokesperson, and other, you know, Bush, and all these other things. So I think the way they frame it right away, you know, really determines what's going to follow. So here's Rumsfeld, and Lara is asking him, again, in his usual, you know, cutting-edge style, you said, quote, "The only defense is a good offense." Now that a major change of U.S. defense policy has taken place, we are now taking preemptory strikes against another country without their attacking us first. And then Rumsfeld said, yes, that's right. We have the right of self-defense under the U.N. Charter. Lara asks him, again, as a follow-up question, I'm just saying, as a matter of history, and this is truly astonishing, coming from the anchor of the NewsHour. He's been there for 27, 28 years now. He said, as a matter of history, the United States has always been attacked and then reacted. Okay, as a matter of history, in my lifetime, as a matter of history, the United States invaded and attacked the Dominican Republic in 1965. It attacked the Republic of South Vietnam, starting with chemical attacks, agents of weapons of mass destruction, Agent Orange, defoliants, in 1961, even 4 years before the Dominican invasion. It later sent direct military intervention forces in 1965. It later invaded and bombed Laos. It later invaded and bombed Cambodia. It later invaded Grenada in 1983. It invaded Panama in 1989. How could Lara possibly say that, as a matter of history, the United States had never conducted a preempted attack? And I've heard no commentary on this anywhere. We are all inside a burqa. You've heard a lot about the burqa, the head-to-toe covering that Islamic women, Muslim women in Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia and other countries are, in many cases, forced to wear. In some cases, it's out of choice, but in many cases, it's compulsory. We are within a very narrow frame of reference that the corporate control media has limited us to talking about. For example, should we attack Iraq? When should we attack Iraq? Is this a propitious time? No, not right now. We don't have enough allied strength. The Europeans are against it. We should try and line up more strength in the Islamic world. No, I think we should go right at them right now while we're feeling our oats. We've got all this capability in the region. It would be so that's the range of opinion. That's the discussion. And often we also fall into that trap of speaking with their language. And one of the greatest examples of subordination to power is when we start using their terminology. We need to break out of that. We need to stop talking about, for example, settlements in the occupied territories. These are not settlements. These are not settlers. These are colonies and these are colonizers. When you call them by their correct name, then the veil is lifted. Then you understand why the Palestinians are so pissed off. Settlers, oh wow, settlers, aren't we all for settlers? Wasn't this land settled by pioneers, a vacant West, and heroic Americans came here to settle this land, has enormously positive resonance with people. But as soon as you say colonists and colonies and colonization, it completely transforms the discourse. So we have to be very, you know, vigilant about the use of language. And who tells the stories? I think that's, you know, a really important point. Who are the storytellers? Who do they represent? The United States is enveloped in propaganda. Propaganda, interestingly, was first used, it has its origins in religion. The Catholic Church in the 17th century, I think it was Pope Gregory, was the first one to use this word to try and roll back the Protestant Reformation. And he said, you know, he sent out these missions of propagandists to disseminate the true holy word of God, the Catholic Church. So it has its roots in the language of religion. And it's interesting to see how often Bush brings up God and the Bible and cites, you know, all these kinds of theistic references. Martin Luther King, his birthday was celebrated in the middle of January, and he's a very interesting example of how propaganda works. King is frozen for all time on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in August of 1963. When he gave, absolutely, a fabulous speech, the I Have a Dream speech. But there was another Martin Luther King that developed in the remaining 5 years of his life. And it's that Martin Luther King that we need to talk about, that we need to celebrate. A king that spoke at Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967, when he finally broke his silence on the war in Vietnam. And let me just read a few of his comments from that particular speech. And this need to maintain social stability for our investments accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters and napalm are being used against guerrillas in Colombia, and why Green Beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. These are words of prophecy. War is not the answer, King said. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. In the last couple of weeks, I've been studying Nazi propaganda, because so much of what I feel is going on right now has its roots in what was unleashed in Europe in the 1930s. And I want to be really careful about what I say, because I think there are, all too often, there are facile connections made between Nazism and fascism and genocide and Holocaust, and these terms are used rather loosely. So, you know, I'm marking my words rather carefully here. But Goebbels said, propaganda to be effective must appear to be invisible, non-coercive. And that somewhat describes what we see here today in our kind of media in front of us. The manufacture of consent is not really enforced by the bludgeon. It's not really something that is an act of coercion. It's an invisible consensus. It has arisen through a culture and an educational system that has propagandized our journalists who have, as I described earlier, has turned them into journalists, from journalists into stenographers. Goebbels said the purpose of Nazi propaganda is to present an ostensible diversity behind which lies an actual uniformity. To present an ostensible diversity behind which lies an actual uniformity. So look at, you know, look at Jennings, look at Brokaw, look at Dan Rather, look at Hannity and Colmes, look at all the talk shows on radio, TV, and TV. There's an appearance, there's a veneer, there's a facade of some diversity. This uniformity in German is called Gleichschaltung, and the achievement of which that was the principal goal of Goebbels' ministry of propaganda. That uniformity, that was absolutely essential. So what do I see today that resonates with Nazi propaganda? You have a very simple message. We are in a war on terrorism. Against whom? The evildoers. The evildoers, why do they hate us? They hate us because we are the beacon of democracy. They hate us because of our values. They hate us because of our freedoms, because of who we are, because of what we stand for. And you get a very simple message that is repeated over and over again with, you know, some little changes in the vocabulary, but you have that constant reification of a simple message, and you create this kind of drumbeat of propaganda. And of course, it must be a message that's not complex. It has to be easily learned. And that is accompanied by slogans that are, again, repeated over and over again. United we stand. Axis of evil is the latest one. Dead or alive, you're with us or you're with the terrorists. We're going to bring the evildoers to justice, or bring justice to the evildoers. So these are the kind of propagandistic slogans that are repeated over and over again, you know, and drop into the collective aquifer, and then are regurgitated and come up in all of these news broadcasts, you know, with flags waving in the background, you know, variants of those basic messages. You must specify the targets for hatred. Well, in the case of the Nazis, it was very clear. It was the Untermenschen, the Jews, the Gypsies, the gays, the communists, the socialists, the union organizers. Target them and focus your target on them. Have a laser beam on them. And here we know it's them, the evildoers. Bin Laden and, you know, his crowd. And then you must create a level of fear in the population in order to enact legislation and to promote military spending that most Americans would, in normal times, would not readily go along with. And as a result, literally suspend various parts of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. That's what the USA Patriot Act is. Another example of propaganda. You call an act which eliminates basic freedoms, freedom of habeas corpus, freedom of information, and many other basic human rights, eliminated, and call that USA Patriot Act. And then finally, one of the other aspects of Nazi propaganda, which I find has a disturbing resonance, which is what is going on today, is what they called an acoustic backdrop. And that is the leaders who deliver these simple messages that are easily learned and that are repeated over and over again are in front of audiences that will be wildly, that are pre-selected and are by definition widely sympathetic and enthusiastic for the message being delivered. So where has Cheney, in his tour of California after he was disinterred from the tomb, where did he speak? He spoke at a Marine base, Camp Pendleton, and he spoke at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, where he got, as expected, tremendous ovation and huge support. And that, in turn, is featured on the evening news. And Americans think, wow, this is the, you know, people are for this stuff. Where did Bush deliver his very first announcement on the $48 million military increase? Elgin Air Force Base in Florida, creating the acoustic backdrop, then molds the population into a kind of groupthink that, wow, there's tremendous support for what the government is doing, and I better get on board on this war of terrorism. Well, that's the official story, you know, very simply reduced. They, the evildoers, hate us because we are who we are, the lovers of freedom. And NPR in particular, and PBS as well, has been really remiss in providing historical background and context. We get that information from the alternative media. So that's really where the future lies and where the hope lies. And it's that independent media that needs to grow and flourish and that needs your support and involvement and that I'm very thrilled to be part of.
That was David Bar-Simeon speaking last month in Santa Cruz, California. Thanks to Free Radio Santa Cruz for that tape. Our final report hits close to home for the producers of this program, especially in light of what we've heard regarding the narrowing of our access as citizens to critical discussions of social policy. We here in the Finger Lakes are fortunate to have Syracuse Community Radio and WEOS to provide perspectives not available elsewhere on the radio dial. What we are about to hear is a report by Paul Riesmandel of WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. His topic, the question of political censorship at our own WEOS. His guest is Jeremy Alderson, the longtime host of The Nobody Show, which was the only locally produced talk show on the station. The Nobody Show was removed from the air suddenly 6 months ago for reasons that were and are unconvincing to this broadcaster. I will make a personal comment following the report.
Jeremy Alderson is a radio host known on the air as Nobody. He is well known in community radio as the founder and producer of the Homelessness Marathon, an annual nationwide broadcast that highlights the issues of homelessness in America. Alderson hosts the marathon live from the streets of a different city each year, staying outside in the cold January night to demonstrate the conditions homeless people deal with every day. Alderson began the Homelessness Marathon at his former home station, WEOS, in Geneva, New York, where he hosted the Nobody Show beginning in August 1992. But on October 4th, 2001, Alderson was notified with little explanation that the show he just finished would be his last. After 6 months of thoughtful investigation, Alderson has decided there's evidence of machinations beneath the surface that resulted in the loss of his radio program, and so he's decided to make the story public. I spoke earlier today with Jeremy by phone from his home in upstate New York.
Well, when I was first tossed off the air, quite unceremoniously, I might add, after more than 9 years, I wasn't even given warning. I was told I had done my last show after I had done it. But when I was thrown off, I had no idea what had hit me. And in the 5 months since then, evidence has begun to accumulate that the reason I was thrown off the air, I'm not making a formal allegation, but I'll say this is what the evidence points to as a likely explanation, is that Cornell University put pressure or communicated in some way with Hobart and William Smith College, which owns my station. They're only 30-something miles apart, and asked to have me thrown off the air because Cornell, I've been a thorn in their side for a while. I'm suing them in court to get them to release documents about their biotech work, and I've won the first two rounds in court, and the evidence seems to be that Cornell very well could have had a hand in this, and that Hobart and William Smith could have very well sold me out, essentially, to a powerful business force in central New York.
And so, the Nobody Show, what did this show cover?
Well, you know, I was covering all the things that a political talk host would cover. The Homelessness Marathon is an offshoot of that, because I was always very concerned about homelessness. I've been concerned about the Middle East. I've been concerned about a wide range of issues that people might expect. But biotechnology has certainly been one of them, both because of its corporate aspect, that it's something being foisted on the American people by these big corporations, and corporate power is perhaps the number one problem we've got right now, but also because it's so particularly dangerous in and of itself. They're asking us to eat this stuff, which may be bad for our health, bad for our children. It may have devastating effects on the environment. So I've been very active in the anti-biotech movement, and that would have been a big theme on the show as well.
And Ithaca University is does a lot of biotechnology research.
Cornell is a major powerhouse in the world, much less in the region. It's a major agricultural research institution, and one of its satellite operations is in Geneva, which is the home of WEOS and radio, and they were trying to expand their ag station in Geneva to build an agriculture and food technology park. ASGRO, which is a division of Monsanto, was early on thought to be, in their press releases, one of the most likely early tenants, although the project got delayed partly because of the activity of my listeners and lobbying assembly members and so forth. So Cornell is extremely active in the area and around the world, and that means that in our area we don't have the problem that you might have where you are, where you might have a kind or two of soybean that's genetically modified and a kind or two of corn. We have every kind of exotic plant there being tested, melons, lettuces, you name it. Papayas are tested, genetically modified papayas are tested in central New York. So the potential for us to have an ecological disaster with one of these genetically modified species interacting in a negative way with the natural environment, for us it's exponentially greater than it is in most communities because we're just exposed to so much more.
Mm-hmm, I see. So at WEOS, were you an employee of the station?
No, I had no legal status there. So I was not a member of, the faculty, not a student. I was a guest. I was a member of the community.
So you did this as a volunteer?
Correct. And for the first 7.5 years I was on that station, I didn't have any problem in that status, and no one ever threatened my status because of anything I said. And by the way, I've never been reprimanded or anything in history. But Hobart and William Smith got a new president, and then things changed. And the new president, interestingly enough, is a guy by the name of Mark Gearin, who was formerly the communications director of the Clinton White House and the campaign manager for Al Gore. And all of a sudden, we start having this very Clinton-esque thing. Gearin was there at the White House when Travelgate occurred. All those people got fired out of the blue. There were allegations of some private agenda behind the firing. There had been no warnings. They were, but it was all in the kind of you can't quite prove it category. Well, here I am all of a sudden. I'm just tossed off the station with no warning. There seemed to be evidence of some private agenda that was behind this. There's a cover story that went out, and it's hard to prove anything. And by the way, the cover story, no one has ever alleged that I did anything wrong. The cover story is that all of a sudden, without warning and overnight, they needed my time slot to have more time to give programming to students. But this is obviously not true because they duplicate programs during the day. The students never filled all of the time slots. The World Cafe, for instance, which is a music show, plays 2 hours in the morning and then 2 hours in the evening. And so this was never true. It was no one ever believed it, that I know. It was just the barest of fig leaf stories. And yet there I am out, and it's kind of like, well, we dare you to prove anything.
So what's next then? I mean, are you going to continue to be able to do the Homelessness Marathon? I guess you were actually already off the air during the last one.
The Homelessness Marathon is at this point independent of WEOS. And, of course, I do think it's a terrible reflection on that station because, and on Mark Gearin, because, after all, after this Homelessness Marathon, I had requests from stations in three different parts of the United States, or from people in three different parts of the United States, would I bring the marathon there? And a station in Montreal asked, can we do our own independent marathon locally in conjunction with yours? This is an event that stations around the country want to have more to do with. The station where it was founded, with this muckamuck in the Democratic Party running the show there now, couldn't have cared less about homeless people. So shame on them that this was the producing station, and they turned their back on this event and tossed me out the door. But there will be more activity on this because the faculty at Hobart and William Smith College circulated a petition asking for my reinstatement. They're going to be having meetings. They're quite concerned about this for the obvious reason that faculty members well understand the implications of people having their work threatened because they took an unpopular stance on something, or they crossed some powerful interest. So they have a real concern, and they are going to be making some inquiries about it on a more formal basis. So this story is not over yet.
Have other changes happened at WEOS?
Yes. The other change that I've been seeing is, I used to think, I mean, with all due respect to WEFT, that WEOS was one of the best stations in the country. Of course, I love WEFT as well, but it presented an enormous amount of alternative, shall we say, political programming, things that you didn't get all on one station. And now I'm seeing more prepackaged programming showing up from big NPR stations, stuff that's very bland, kind of the NPRization of WEOS. I find that a very negative development there. And they are also doing more things like presenting speeches on campus and stuff like that, which is they're making it more and more into a tool of promoting the university and the image of the university.
Yeah, that's a trend we're seeing in many university stations across the country.
Right. And so it's less a forum for diverse opinions and for reflecting what's going on in the community or for discussing issues. By the way, Paul, there's one other thing I would want your listeners to know. One of the interesting little things about this, one of the pieces of evidence, and there are several, that they threw me off and they claimed it was pressure from students needing slots, but there was never an explanation for why they needed it just that day and couldn't give any warning to me. But, in fact, the day before I was thrown off, there had been a police report about somebody slashing tires at Cornell's Geneva Ag Station. And they, that coincidence is just a little too great. I had done a broadcast a few days before where I had mentioned Cornell. And then they had their tires slashed, and the next thing you know, I'm off the air, as if someone from Cornell had blamed me for that. Now, I never encouraged that kind of thing, and in fact, in court, they tried to tell the judge that releasing Freedom of Information documents to me about their biotechnology work would be an invitation to eco-terrorism, and the judge just completely ignored this and did not rule in their favor. So they've even tried to raise this claim in court and gotten nowhere with it. The question is, did they try to raise this with Mark Guerin and get somewhere with it despite so little evidence, no evidence, that a judge basically, you know, just laughed at this, and yet maybe they got somewhere with it in private with a friendly audience with Mark Guerin, and that's one of the concerns that I have.
Unfortunately, these interactions between two university presidents or university administrations are not a court of law and don't even carry some of the very basic fundamental burdens of proof.
That's correct, and there's no access to them. There's no sunshine law for this.
Well, Jeremy, I assume this isn't going to stop you.
Well, I'm moving more into a public speaking career now. I mean, one thing I like about public speaking is that there's thousands of places where you can speak, and there, as opposed to in radio, where the radio marketplace is just controlled by so few people, and that it's quite chilling.
Well, you'll have a few minutes a day, and hopefully we'll be hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
And that was Jeremy Alderson, also known as Nobody, talking about how he was kicked off the air at WEOS Geneva, New York.
As a resident of the Geneva area, as well as a broadcaster on WEOS, I believe the matter of the cancellation of the Nobody Show should be of great concern to the community. Along with Jeremy, who is a friend of mine, I find the claim that the program was removed for the official reasons given unconvincing. I have not asked Mark Guerin, the Hobart president, for a comment on the matter, as I expect him to reiterate the official reason as previously given. I would not expect the station manager, Mike Black, to shed any further light on the matter as his and his family's livelihood depends on the goodwill of his boss, Mr. Guerin. I have quite a bit of experience with the issue of censorship in non-commercial radio. Those of you who listen to Democracy Now! Will be aware that a more than 7-year battle over these issues has taken place at Pacifica Radio. I have been extremely active in that struggle. And though I haven't covered those issues on this program, longtime listeners to the Nobody Show will have heard me interviewed as Jeremy's guest over the past few years, while I still lived in Los Angeles, as a staff member of the Los Angeles Pacifica station from which I had been banned and fired in 1995 for criticizing a new administration. I spent 7 years fighting that battle and, in my opinion, fighting for WIAS to remain an alternative conduit of information is as crucial to our community as the Pacifica stations are to theirs. And if you don't hear this show in the future, I will have been banned from my second station. The specific allegations that Jeremy makes concerning the Ag Biotech Park are of special concern to me as a resident of the Geneva area. I'm an organic gardener, and I am outraged at the creation of a new source of biocontamination right in my backyard. If not for the Nobody Show, we wouldn't be hearing about this except as rah-rah boosterism. What was also not mentioned in Jeremy's interview with WEFT was that Hobart William Smith Colleges, under the leadership of Guerin, has been an active advocate for the construction of the park. Why is a 4-year liberal arts college like Hobart taking a position on what I can only see as corporate carpetbagging of the people and ecosystem of the Finger Lakes? As usual, with the justification of a few measly jobs and the total failure of the local press, with the exception of the Nobody Show, to serve as a watchdog for my interests, for our interests. Our member of Congress in this area, Tom Reynolds, never met an ecosystem he didn't want to destroy. He sponsored a bill to drill for oil and gas in the Alaska Wildlife Refuge. He was the only elected official in the affected area to oppose a ban on drilling in our Finger Lakes National Forest, and he has pulled out all the stops to pump taxpayer money, more than $500,000 worth, into the construction of the biotech park. Some of the things that Jeremy said in his interview I don't agree with. I don't think that WIAS is being NPRized, at least not at this point. WIAS has long played quite a bit of programming from NPR. WEOS has, unlike other NPR affiliates, played a great many independent radical programs. And I personally believe that it is a good thing for the community and for the station as an educational licensee to broadcast lectures going on at the colleges. The best education I received was from Pacifica Radio, listening to lectures, which is why this program plays so many lectures for you. Assuming that a Hobart student doesn't suddenly develop a need for unwelcome guests' time slot, we will continue to keep you informed on these issues. The producers of this program would like to encourage all parties who wish to appear regarding this matter to contact us at unwelcome@radioforall.net and schedule an interview.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. They'll take the money.